I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. We're all aware that undocumented migrants attempt to cross our southern border every day, and we know that many do make it into America. But there are hundreds who don't. Some die along the border and end up in unmarked graves. Today, meet the anthropologist who works to return these unidentified persons to their families. Then, a self-proclaimed grammar cheerleader explains her take on teaching English. We'll ask her if, in this era of 140 characters, why sentence structure and punctuation even matter. Later, Brian McTavish brings us the weekend to-do list. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Not every undocumented migrant who attempts to cross our southern border makes it. For some who die along the way, they can end up in unmarked graves along the U.S.-Mexico border. For the families waiting to hear of a relative safe entry into America, that news may never come. Our next guest works to bring closure to those waiting families. Dr. Lori Baker is an associate professor of anthropology at Baylor University, who specializes in forensic analysis of skeletal remains. She's the founder of the Reuniting Families Project that works to identify those persons who perished along the border. She joins me here in the studio. And Dr. Baker, Lori, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk about this with folks today.
Well, what caused you to try identifying these remains and then launching something called the Reuniting Families Project?
Well, a very short version of that is just becoming aware as an undergraduate student that there were individuals dying along the border and there was no mechanism for this identification process. And then as becoming developed in academia and realizing that I actually had the ability to do something about it drove me to start the project.
This project is part of the ICFI. That's the International Consortium for Forensic Identification. That's a mouthful. What is that?
Well, it's just basically bringing a consortium of people together, people that have expertise. We don't have a federal program to do this work, and so we don't have infrastructure for it, although I hope one day we will. So we have to bring a lot of different experts together in a lot of different arenas and a lot of international folks to make these identifications possible.
You know, how do these people die, the folks who are attempting to cross the border? Do we know much about that, Lori?
We know some about it from research that's been done in Arizona, where they've been much more organized in this process. Most folks, when we can tell a reason for death, then we find a lot of skeletal remains in the desert, so it's difficult to ascertain cause and manner of death. But
meaning you can't tell someone who's trying to cross the border from someone who's out just walking around.
People should be pretty concerned because we assume that people are undocumented border crossers, but at the beginning point, we don't know if they're U.S. citizens, if they're foreign nationals, why they're there. Many of the cases, especially the ones we work on, we don't even know if they're victims of homicides. And so most of the cases that we've examined have had no investigation whatsoever done for them.
How often do you come across the homicide out there? Because you can tell, right, from the work you do most of the time?
Many times. It depends. I mean, if someone's perished long ago and there are a few bones, we may not see the evidence on the skeleton. But unfortunately, there are some areas of the border where there are quite a number of homicides. And to know that those homicides haven't been investigated should give everyone pause, because it means we don't have rule of law on the U.S. side of the border.
Does that surprise you?
It should surprise everyone. I mean, we live in an age of CSI where people have a certain expectation that we have all of these resources, technology, and expertise. And to realize that none of those are being used or deployed along the border should make people very concerned.
Okay, we got off talking about homicides here. How about other folks who are attempting to cross the border? How might they be perishing out there?
The majority die from exposure. So it's very hot during the day and cold at night. And so there is dehydration and kidney function failure, but the majority, actually, it's exposure.
Sounds brutal.
It's horrible. I've had, I think, one heat stroke and two heat exhaustion episodes, and there's not a time that we're working in the summer that somebody isn't in the hospital.
Have you had a chance to talk to people who do actually make it and what they experience trying to get across that border?
It's incredible what people go through. And the thing that has been the most concerning the last few years are the number of children that are crossing, because children regulate heat. They're not as capable as adults at regulating heat, so it's much more difficult on them.
So they're more vulnerable, the kids.
They're much more vulnerable.
I would have guessed just the opposite, because they're young and maybe a little tougher than us old folks.
No, they're not able to regulate heat, so they overheat so drastically that they end up going into heat stroke. And in 2014, just in the Rio Grande Valley, which is one border sector running through Texas, we had 70,000 children that we know of that crossed, that were apprehended.
70,000 in one sector?
One small sector of the border. And of that, 85% of those kids were unaccompanied. They were on their own, traveling by themselves. And so in discussing this with family members, there was one 15-year-old kid that we identified from Guatemala, and talking to his mom, you have to ask, why would you let your son make this journey? You know that the chances of him surviving this journey through Mexico and on his own, that he'll most likely be robbed, he could be brutalized, murdered, and he didn't make it. And the responses from these families, and especially these moms, is he was told he would join the gang. If he didn't join the gang, he'd be murdered, and they'd probably murder the family as well.
If he had stayed in Guatemala.
If he had stayed in Guatemala. And if he joined the gang, he wouldn't live long because of the violence in that culture. So she said, we had no choice. At least knowing that there's hope if he makes it safely to the U.S. is worth that try.
That gamble's worth the price.
It's heart-wrenching to think that a mom had to make that decision. I have a 13-year-old, and the idea of letting him walk across town by himself just terrifies me. And to imagine, you know, having a child that's traveling that many thousands of miles without anyone to look after them is an unbelievable choice to have to make. But they've watched their friends be murdered in both of those scenarios. They know it's going to happen.
So we're talking about children ages ranging from what to what? How young are some of these kids?
Oh, we have women who give birth along the way. So we have neonatal babies. We have people crossing with young infants. Most of the children that I'm talking about here, we're looking at, you know, age 6 to 17.
Age 6 to 17.
We rescued a couple of kids 2 years ago, a 9-year-old and a 6-year-old, that were walking across a ranch. And of course, these families pay for someone to help escort their children across.
The coyote, right?
Yeah. And these coyotes, I mean, the kids couldn't keep up. They weren't staying on schedule, so they just left them behind. So here they were wandering around a ranch, and it is a miracle that they were found.
You know, what percentage of people who try to cross the border die in the process? Do you have any sense of that? Or is it impossible to know?
It's fairly impossible to know. When we're talking about people that are working outside of the system, it's difficult. And so all the numbers we have are based on apprehensions and then based on estimates. And we had a series of initiatives in the 90s to help close the border at major cities. And that redirected migrants into areas that were inhospitable. And the hopes really of the government was that if it was so likely you'd be apprehended crossing, that you would choose not to cross because the only other options would be these places where people can't live easily or well. And that didn't.
But that's not stopping people.
Well, it's not, because we're working not just with folks that have economic difficulties in supporting their families, but we're working in folks in very dangerous situations. And so many of the folks that are coming to the U.S. are refugees, like these young kids that I'm talking about, where they cannot live safely where they are, and they're trying to find somewhere to be safe. So we've seen a number of changes, one of which is the affluency of the people that are crossing. We used to see individuals mostly coming from Mexico. Now we're seeing individuals coming from Central America in greater numbers, especially in the state of Texas. But we're also seeing folks that are coming from the middle class rather than the poorest of the poor because of the violence issues. So it's a broad, broad problem that we have.
And that begins to speak pretty clearly to exactly how extreme the dangers are in some of these countries.
So we know that the numbers increased in the 90s. So finally, by 1999, the government started keeping records of those that are of the remains that are found along the border. The problem is, you know, that system of record keeping. Most of the cases that I've worked on, and we're talking about hundreds of cases, have not been included in the Border Patrol statistics.
Mm-hmm.
So in these cases, there's no record of them to even be able to ascertain the number of people that perished. And some of that's because we're talking about these poor rural Texas counties. The main city and county that we've been working in is Brooks County in Falfurrias, Texas. And It's a 955 square mile county, 7,000 residents. 40% of the folks live below the poverty line. They have no resources, expertise, technology. They have no way of dealing with these kinds of international identification cases, mm-hmm. and they receive absolutely zero federal government money for immigration issues. And there are hundreds of thousands of people that are crossing through this county and hundreds of deaths that are happening each year in this one poor county.
So. Dr. Lori Baker is my guest. She's a founder of a group called the Reuniting Families Project. It works to identify persons who perish attempting to cross the border and get those remains back to family members. She'll be giving the opening lecture for the exhibition Connecting the Dots, the Science of CSI this evening at the Linda Hall Library. The event begins at 7. It's free and open to the public, but e-tickets are required. For more information, go to lindahall.org. So how do you begin to find the remains that are out there? I assume some of them are exposed, some of them are buried. How do you go about that?
Well, most are exposed. And it's really, if you think about these areas that we're talking about, in Texas, we have these large ranches. So we have huge pieces of land with very few people living on them. So most of the areas we're working, we're talking about ranches in the 65,000 acre range, which is beyond my comprehension.
Yeah.
The King Ranch, the largest ranch that we have in the U.S., is 825,000 acres, which is larger than the state of Rhode Island.
Hmm.
So it's not an easy task to find folks in these areas. And I imagine that most we don't ever come across. So it's opportunistic that there are ranchers out and either they notice vultures about and imagine that cattle went down. Now they imagine that there's a human that might need to be recovered.
Mm-hmm. And so a rancher notices something, then notifies you?
Well, no, not usually. They'll notify the sheriff's department
okay.
for that county, and the sheriff's department will handle this. And so most of the counties we're working, the sheriff's department goes out, handles these cases, works with the JP because we don't even have medical examiners. It's a justice of the peace. And
mm-hmm.
this is the system that really blows my mind. And I almost hate to talk about it, especially outside of the state of Texas, because it makes us look quite bad. We have 254 counties and 14 medical examiner's offices.
Wow.
Which means we have a lot of counties.
State.
It's a huge state. And so we have these areas where instead of a medical examiner system, we have justices of the peace who are elected officials, and they're in charge of determining the cause and manner of death. Unfortunately, they don't have the background training that a medical examiner has. Their requirements, because they're elected officials, they have to be 18 years of age. They have to be U.S. citizens, residents of the county for a certain period of time. They can't be felons. And my favorite is they have to be mentally competent.
Well, thank you very much.
Incredibly prepared to do this kind of work and to be tasked with determining cause and manner of death in these unexplained cases and unattended deaths.
Then do the justices of the peace thing get a hold of you guys?
Well, most of the time, the process that has happened in our Texas counties is that the JP goes out, signs a death certificate, the remains go to a cemetery, and they're buried in unmarked graves or graves that are marked with an unknown marker.
How do you get involved then?
I go county to county and say, I know that you have this going on. I know that you need help in forensic science. And we're talking about good people. These aren't people with ill will. They just don't have the tools or the technology or the expertise or the finances to deal with this. So I offer to help in whatever way we can. And what we've been greeted with among these officials is thank you. We had no idea what to do. I mean, they certainly notified the consulates. The consulates are overwhelmed. They don't know what to do. So just trying to offer services to aid in that process.
And so then do you go to these unmarked graves and unearth them and then proceed with identification?
We do. We do. And what we found is that there are so many
cemeteries. This is really a breathtaking system you're describing to me here.
It's a horrible failure of a lack of system that's shocking.
And given the gravity of the problem, particularly, it's almost like people don't want to confront the reality in front of them there.
Oh, absolutely. And it's an overwhelming thing. And then you also have folks, you know, the CSI effect, talking about this lecture here in town tonight. The CSI effect has given people this idea that we have this extraordinary forensic science that happens on these types of cases. And the reality is we don't have any of that happening on these cases. And
so how do you identify them?
Oh, it's a long process.
Clothing?
Sometimes clothing. We've just started. We work a lot with the National Missing and Unidentified Person System to put all of this information in. But we've just started a database through the Texas Observer. And these wonderful photojournalists got motivated to do something. And so they come to our labs and photograph all of the clothing and the personal items that people have made this database that's easy to use in Spanish and in English so that people can go through and look at things. I mean, we find things like wedding rings, but you can't wear them because these folks are getting robbed all the way to the U.S. And so they're sewn into the lining of their clothing. So things are just hidden throughout, and we look for those little clues. And then when we do find them, we can put photographs out so that people can identify the objects. And it's a tool, and it's, you know, still a needle in a haystack tool, but it has been successful.
Well, I was going to say, tell us about a story where a family was reunited with someone who had died through their remains, because I imagine you hang on to those moments as pretty gratifying and keeps you going, Lori.
There are so many stories. Probably the one that I think about the most is the very first identification that I had. I didn't want to be a forensic scientist. I just happened to have the skills. I actually work in ancient DNA, and there just weren't people who could do bone DNA in forensic cases. And so I ended up doing this work by chance or providence. But the first case I had, and not really, I mean, if you think about forensic science, it's got a lot of entertainment value because you're trying to solve something. You know, mm-hmm. It's a big mystery.
It's a mystery,
it's a
puzzle. Yeah.
You got to put it together. But forensic scientists are never called to anything because something good happened.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a hard reality of an everyday life.
How do you deal with that?
Well, you think about these cases and these folks that you're working with. And so I wasn't sure that our project would be worthwhile. I didn't know if families wanted this information. You know,
what made you doubt that? Because you think they would.
Well, you do. But then there's this hope that their loved one is somewhere else living well. And they know it's not true because they would call. But just I'm taking that hope away from a family that their loved one is still alive and living well somewhere else. But this first case, I unfortunately knew too much about it as it went on. But it was a mother of two young girls who lived with her mom in the Yucatan in Mexico. They lived in a house with dirt floors, no running water. And this woman's husband had left her, so she was responsible for caring for her two young daughters, and she needed to provide an education for them so they'd have a different life. But there was no economic way to do that available to her, so she decided to come to the U.S.
Leave her kids behind.
Leave her kids with her mom. And her sister said, you're going to get raped, maybe murdered. You know, you just can't do this. And she said, I have to do this. We don't have any other option, and I'll send money back, and I'm going to change their life. Well, she happened to be traveling with a group with a coyote that she also had a cousin with her. And she sprained her ankle. The cousin helped to carry her as long as he could, but it slowed the group down.
Right.
The coyote said, leave her here. I'll come back and get her and take care of her once I get you where you're going.
Of course, he didn't. Yeah.
Well, and if he did, she had already perished, but probably he didn't go back.
Right.
And so knowing these things as I'm doing the final identification after getting a DNA sample from her mom, and realizing I'm about to tell this mom that her daughter's died, and I'm about to tell these two young girls they're not getting their mom back. So now they don't have a mom or a dad, and what are their circumstances? How much worse is it now that they don't have any either of their parents there to help them to flourish and thrive and change their circumstance. And it just devastated me. I was pregnant with my first child, and I thought, oh, you know, this is the last thing she would have wanted for her family. Her name was Rosa Cano. Think about her all the time.
And you identified her how?
You know, we were lucky in this case that she had an ID with her. Most of the time when there's an identification, either card or information, it's not really belonging to that person. It's false identification. So we weren't really hopeful that it was her, except that she fit the profile. And so we had to do DNA comparisons to make sure that it was her. And so that was helpful because it was a case where we had some information to go off of. When I made the identification in the lab, I honestly cried. I just cried because I thought this is a horrible thing to do to this family.
You knew enough about the case to know that this mom was leaving these two young girls behind.
And I knew a lot about this case, too. We were connected with Lisa Ling, who works with National Geographic Explorer. And she had been doing an investigation of people crossing the border, undocumented folks living in the U.S., why they were moving. And she had become involved in this case. And because I was pregnant, when the remains went back to the mom, I wanted to go as well, and I couldn't because I was too far along in pregnancy, and Lisa went with the team. And when they walked up to the mother, she came running up. She saw these Americans. She thought one of them was me, and she just cried and cried and threw her arms around her and just kept saying, "Thank you, Doctora. Thank you, Doctora. Thank you, Doctora. And of course, the whole team is just, you know, they haven't experienced that before. And my question to this mom is this worthwhile? Do you want to know this information, or is it worse that you know this information? And she said, no, it's the hope eats you alive every day. And since then, that's the question that I ask moms. Is this worth knowing? Have I made your life worse by giving you this information?
And most of the time, I imagine you're finding out that they do want the information,
they
right?
They do. And the problem is you're ungrounded. We have a grieving process as humans that we go through, and that's truncated when you don't have information. Mm-hmm. And these mothers of young kids say they walk around their house. They don't know what to do. They just walk around aimlessly. They have nowhere to go. When we make an identification and send remains back, the mothers always say, thank you. Now I have a place to go and pray. Mm-hmm. Now I have a place to lay flowers. I can be with my child.
Yeah.
And that's a very important thing that we're not giving back to these families.
You know, it's like in journalism a lot of times, you know, you have to call families who have suffered a big loss and through some heinous thing. And so many times folks want to talk. They want to tell the stories of the lives that have been lost. And as a journalist, you're thinking, you hesitate to make that call. But it's counterintuitive a lot of times, I guess.
It's very difficult for me because I want these stories told and I want to give families that opportunity. And there are some wonderful journalists that want to tell these stories. But I'm always concerned that I'm victimizing the family further by exposing them to folks and making them talk about it over and over again.
So how long ago did you form Reuniting Families, the Reuniting Families Project?
I moved to Texas to do it in the fall of 2002, and we launched it in the spring of 2003.
How many matches have you made over the years?
Oh, goodness. Now we're in the hundreds, I guess. We've made some difference, but it's barely a dent.
Well, again, just to tell our listeners, Dr. Lori Baker will be speaking tonight at the Linda Hall Library. The event begins at 7. It's free. It's open to the public. E-tickets are required. More information, go to lindahall.org. And Dr. Baker's group, again, is called the Reuniting Families Project. Thank you for your good work. Thanks for coming in today and sharing your story. I appreciate it, Lori.
Thank you very much for giving me this opportunity.
Okay. Time for a break here. When we come back, we're going to change topics dramatically. We're going to talk about the glories of grammar. You heard me right. Grammar, folks. Periods, commas, and all that good stuff. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. Now a look at grammar with a woman who insists she's not here to make anybody feel badly about their lack of knowledge about all things semicolons and commas and possessives. Lisa McClendon is what she calls a grammar cheerleader because she appreciates its place in our world and the great tool that it is. After all, grammar is designed to help people understand what another person is trying to communicate via the written word. She's out with a new book on this subject, The Perfect English Grammar Workbook. She runs the Bremer Editing Center at the University of Kansas Journalism School, where she also teaches editing, writing, and grammar. She's a former copy editor at the Wichita Eagle, and she joins us now from the studios of KPR over in Lawrence. And Lisa, nice to have you. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, you run the Bremer Editing Center at KU, as I just mentioned. Remind us who John Bremer was, because my wife had him as a journalism professor many years ago, and she's talked about him so many times over the years.
That's a common thread among alumni that I meet. John Bremer was just a legend in copy editing. He was apparently, I didn't know the man. He was long gone from KU. You know, by the time I got here. Mm-hmm. But apparently he was a very imposing physical presence,
yes,
as well as having a big booming voice and a voluminous knowledge of language, editing, and just everything in general. And so he really inspired, you know, a whole generation of KU Journalism School graduates. And so the Editing Center now bears his name, and we at the center advocate for the craft of editing, as well as working individually with School of Journalism students on polishing their writing and understanding the mechanics of language and that sort of thing.
I'm told he would occasionally open up the window when he was stymied by his class, which might not understand what a semicolon was, and he'd scream out the window, "I'm surrounded by students,
yes,
who don't understand semicolons. Can someone help me?"
Yeah, I've heard that too, and I've heard it from enough different people that I'm sure he did it for effect more than anything.
I think,
you know,
that's probably
after
correct.
A while, but yeah, people remember him very, very fondly.
You call yourself a grammar cheerleader, Lisa, and you talk in the book about how much you enjoy words and how they're strung together. How could anybody love grammar?
Well, grammar is really interesting. I think the problem is that people think it's dry and boring, but
right,
it's fascinating how language works. It's fascinating how language changes. It's really interesting how rules become rules and how not rules become rules. That's really an interesting part, too. And I think that if people kind of understand that grammar is a tool that you use to make your own communication better rather than a hammer that somebody's going to hit you with, then, you know, just kind of the attitude about it is really, you know, kind of what I'm hoping to change through, you know, my teaching and working at the Bremer Center and writing this book, because grammar is, you know, I mean, we all use it. That's the thing. We all use it whether we know it or not, whether we call it that or not. But sometimes, you know, learning how to name specific aspects of grammar that you're using can really demystify that,
yeah,
and make it not scary and not boring. And then when you look at how things work, I mean, it's always interesting to see how things work, right?
Mm-hmm.
Everybody loves those shows about the potato chip factory. Well, this is the language factory. And, you know, it's kind of how sentences get made and how words get put together. And it's really interesting. I don't know. I mean, I guess it's not interesting to everybody, but it's really interesting to me. So,
well, and it goes back to what the founding of language back centuries ago, right? I mean, have we traced all that? And when people began to figure out the rules that go along with words?
Well, to an extent, yeah. I mean, as long as we've had written language,
mm-hmm,
you know, spoken language, there are linguists who work on, you know, reconstructing Proto-Indo-European and things like that. That's not really where I work.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But yeah, I mean, when you have written language, you can sort of see. And when you're looking at a language like Latin that's dead, you can construct a very nice, neat grammar of Latin because it's dead. It's not changing.
Right.
And the thing about living languages, they change. And so you can construct a grammar of Old English or Middle English or Jane Austen's English.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not going to be the same English that we have today. It may be really similar, but it may not be exactly the same. And things that were, you know, rules then aren't really rules now. And things that weren't rules then are rules now. That's what's kind of interesting, too, is that there are a lot of grammar, you know, I'm going to use air quotes here. You can't see that on the radio, but I'm doing it with my fingers. rules that don't have any basis in actual English grammar. They're just somebody's peeve that they wrote in a book 150 years ago and then are suddenly taken as the gospel of grammar. And that's why I really That's why I like the phrase grammar cheerleader, because I like the interesting points of grammar. And I really don't like the idea of a grammar cop, or especially a grammar Nazi, because Nazis are just not funny at all.
Yeah.
And nobody wants to be a Nazi. And, you know, let's not dilute the idea of Nazis. But
So many people lack confidence when it comes to grammar. And I see it in my students. I'm sure you see it in yours, too. And they know they don't know it. And that sort of adds to the problem here, doesn't it?
I think that's part of it. And I think, you know, that lack of confidence, again, it's all about the attitude. Most of what you know about grammar is fine, because guess what? You use language. You speak English, you know? I mean, if you speak English, you pretty much understand how nouns and adjectives have to work together, how verbs have to follow a noun, and how things conjugate, and how a sentence gets put together, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
We speak it fine. When it comes to writing, people get a little more nervous, because writing does have some rules that speech doesn't have.
Right.
You know, that speaking, we have a lot more context. We have body language. We have tone that you don't have in the written word. And so it's necessarily a little bit more formal, and you need a little bit more context in writing. But yeah, I mean, I think a lot of times what I tell my students is trust your ear on some of this. You'll get it if you just sort of say it out loud, and that's what it is, because you know this.
You know, I can't help but wonder, you know, Lisa, to what extent social media these days is doing serious damage to grammar, because sometimes in my classroom, I mean, the concept of periods and commas seems as foreign to my students sometimes as the man in the moon.
I think that's something that I've heard a lot, that, oh, my God, you know, the Internet's ruining language. Well, you know, something's been ruining English for centuries. And if you go back far enough, you'll hear somebody crabbing in the 4th century about how kids today are ruining Latin. So, I mean, this it really, you can.
Kids these days. Yeah.
Yeah. Kids these days just, you know, they don't know how to do that. If anything, honestly, I think that the Internet has made written communication more important. It's made it a whole lot more prominent. And, yeah, people don't use punctuation the same way. People do use emoji. Or emojis, if you want to make it plural. It's kind of my belief that if we snatch a word into English from another language, we kind of get to make it fit our pattern. So,
right.
You know, if you say emojis, it's fine. It's plural, even though it's already plural, I think. but anyway, the thing is that you're presenting yourself through the written word. All right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, on Twitter, on Facebook to an extent, not on Instagram, where you're obviously doing pictures, but it makes written communication that much more important, and it makes clarity that much more important. And, you know, at some point you get to where you don't want to look like an idiot on social mm-hmm. media, and therefore you use capital letters and you use punctuation. And it's really interesting. If you're just texting your friends, no one cares. But all of a sudden, when you move into that professional sphere,
right.
You realize, I actually need to make sure this is spelled right. I need to use capital letters. I need to use proper punctuation.
Yeah, but if you're using bad habits when you're doing social media, those carry over sometimes into the real stuff.
They can. I think they can. And I think that, you know, conscientious professionals realize that, and they know that, okay, I need to clean this up a little bit.
Yeah.
You know, and it will affect the perception of them one way or another if they don't get there.
So when people ask you about the most common mistakes in grammar and maybe what you see in your students, what do you point to?
Apostrophes, technically that's not grammar. I mean, I guess
it sort of depends
on your definition of grammar.
Okay.
I mean, you can define grammar as, you know, morphology and syntax, how words and sentences are put together. You can use it. I mean, I generally adopt a broader definition of rules that govern the way we use language.
That comes across in your book. It's broader than just,
It's much broader than that. And so, you know, I think people, the common people will define grammar in that broader sense. If you talk to a linguist, a specialist, they'll say, well, you know, that's not grammar. Punctuation isn't grammar. Spelling isn't grammar. And it's not, according to that definition.
So apostrophes, what do people do in your view?
People put them in where they don't need them
and
leave them out where they do need them.
And same with commas, right? I see that all the time. People just don't get commas.
People get commas better than apostrophes, I think.
Okay, I'd buy that.
Yeah, I think the problem with commas is that there are some places where you have to have a comma.
Mm-hmm.
There are some places where you can't have a comma.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's this whole gray area in the middle where you can use one if you want to, and it's not wrong if you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think people lose confidence with commas, because they're never sure, is this an optional comma or a required comma?
Yeah.
And that makes it a little trickier. But apostrophes, that's one of those things where people see it wrong so often that they lose all confidence in what's right.
Well, speaking of lack of confidence, I've been a journalist for 35 years, and I just have thrown up the white flag here when it comes to the verb lie, as in incline. There's lie, there's lay, there's lane, and I just tend to write around it because I know I'm pathetic. I just don't get when to use which one, and it's like ridiculous.
Well, that's actually something I just had my students working on last week.
you should have called me. I could have come over. Yeah, I could have used it.
Yeah, but have a whole exercise on that. Yeah. What I tell them, and this is, it's tricky because there's not
a
real easy rule to remember. I mean, there are some word pairs that you can, you know, there's a little trick that you can remember, like affect and effect and things like that. But lie and lay, right. I just say, look, if you can put B in and the sentence still makes sense, then you want lie. You want lie, lay, lane.
Like, what do you mean put B in? What do you mean?
Okay, so the dog is lying on the rug. The dog is being on the rug, okay?
Oh.
I mean, it doesn't sound, it sounds kind of awkward, but it makes sense.
Right, right.
Okay? My dog likes to lie in the sun. My dog likes to be in the sun. Okay, so you're swapping lie and be because lie can't take a direct object. It's intransitive. So when do you use lay? You use lay when you can swap in put, because you're actually putting something. Mm-hmm. Lay is transitive. It's got to have a direct object. You have to be moving something.
Why don't we just abolish the whole verb form? Get rid of it, because it's ridiculous.
I think it's going that way.
Yeah. Do you?
I think it is. No, I really do. I really think it is going that way.
Like,
I think
who uses lane, L-A-I-N? No one uses that.
Nobody uses that. They said, you know, after I had laid in the sun all day.
Right.
Because that's what everybody says.
Right.
Yeah, that's one of those things. And if the past tense of lie weren't lay, none of this would be confusing. But it is. And it is. And I think that distinction is collapsing. I think it's... It may collapse in my lifetime, which would be kind of cool to watch.
This is really exciting. This is like a reason to live, then, if this happens, then.
Yeah. Hey, and I'm pulling for whom to leave, too. So
that was one on my list here. It's in your book. You know, a tough one. When you use who and when you use whom, W-H-O-M, as in Mary, what do you advise there?
I advise my students at this point, when in doubt, go with who. No, I do. And
that's
I tell
good.
Them this. And I explain to them there's a trick where you can tell which one you need. And I'll tell you that in a minute. But I say, when in doubt, use who. Because even if you're wrong, no one will notice.
That's probably true.
Whereas, and a lot of people use whom when they really need who. It really should be who. And they put whom in there. And then they're wrong and pretentious.
Yes.
And so, you know, it's like, okay, better to be wrong and have no one notice than be wrong and pretentious.
Mm-hmm.
The trick is, can you substitute he or him, and the him has the same sound as whom, so that's why we use that one. They or them, and you can do it that way. So if you can substitute in they, you want who. If you can substitute in them, you want whom. And this seems straightforward, but if you have an example like, you know, the man blank police say ran a meth lab out of his garage.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, people want to put whom in there. The man whom police say ran a meth lab. Well, it's not. It actually should be police say he ran a meth lab, not police say him ran a meth lab. So it's who. And so that's why I say, when in doubt, just use who. It's probably right anyway, and even if it's not, no one will notice.
Well, Lisa, I have a question here, which is, here you have two journalism professors talking about grammar, and the question at this point, is anyone out there listening to us talking about who and whom
who
and
knows?
Lay and lie and all that stuff? Yeah.
More people than you think.
I hope so. I hope so.
You know, I'm going to the American Copy Editors Society conference next week. We have an annual conference. And
you people get together and talk about this stuff. Yeah.
Get together and talk about this stuff. And it is a grand time. And it's a great group of people. And we always have a good time.
That's
and
great.
Yes, we have hour-long discussions about hyphens. So.
Well, Lisa McClendon is the author of The Perfect English Grammar Workbook. Lisa, you got to come back and go through some of these things for our listeners some other time down the road, too.
Super. I'd love to.
Did a great job, Lisa. Thanks very much.
All right. Thank you.
Coming up now, Brian McTavish in your weekend to-do list.
Don't need permission. Made my decision to test my limits. Cause it's my business. God is my witness. Stop what I finished. Don't need no holder. Taking control of this kind of moment. I'm locked and loaded. Completely focused. My mind is open. All that you got. Gonna skin on my neck. Don't you stop, boy.
Well, look who's here. Brian McTavish, who comes in here every week to talk about cool stuff to do on your weekend, and he's sitting right here. How are you, buddy?
Well, it's you.
Who, whom?
It's my, me.
My, lay, lane. You, you know all those
hey,
things, don't you?
No, not anymore.
Because you were...
No.
Not anymore. Did you ever? Did you ever?
A little bit,
maybe. Did you get edited a lot when you were down at the Star, or
no?
Were you an easy edit?
Easy for me to say now.
Well,
but
of course.
It was a super easy edit. I had an unfair advantage.
Which was?
Well, unfair or not, I wrote the way I talked. And oh. I talk good.
You're supposed to talk good.
Hear the joke? I talk good.
Talk good, yeah, I get it.
I talk well.
Right.
But, you know, I had a great time
Lisa
writing.
Lisa McClendon would be all over you right now.
Oh, my! You connected with her.
I did. Liked her.
And she, yeah. I think she liked you, too.
Who's singing? Come on, who's singing right now?
Ariana Grande. It's you, it's me, and it's Ariana, the
pop princess.
Yes. 7:30 Saturday night.
We still have pop princesses.
Oh, yes. Yes, it's just one right after the other, and they're all so good and young and talented, and they all get sexed up at some point after being child stars. Anyway, Ariana Grande. She's getting it started. 7:30 Saturday at the Sprint Center. She's on her Dangerous Woman tour.
There you go.
Exactly. It was only a few years ago that she was on Nickelodeon. She played a character called Cat Valentine on a show called Victorious. There was a spinoff called Sam and Cat. And the next thing you know, she puts out big hit albums. Yours Truly, followed by My Everything, followed by last year's mega smash, Dangerous Woman. And I don't know how dangerous she is, but I mean, you know, I guess some parents might want to think at least twice before they accompany their 12 and 13-year-old daughters.
Ariana Grande, 7:30 Saturday night at the Sprint Center.
It's going to be grande.
How does she do that? Patti LaBelle, that's incredible. How do you do that?
Okay, she's 72,
what is
Steve.
That? Is she still doing that?
She's 72, and she's still doing that, Steve. There are catty fans of Patti LaBelle who say, Aretha Franklin? I don't think so.
No.
Which is catty.
That is catty.
Anyway, Soul Sister Supreme, or at least Extraordinaire, listen to this. I know.
Where's she going to be?
She is going to be at the Muriel Kaufman Theater at the Kaufman Center for the Performing Arts at 8 o'clock on Friday evening.
And also, she's making an appearance on Saturday.
You tell me.
2 o'clock Saturday, 63rd Street and Warnell Road, I'm told.
Oh, my goodness.
The Brookside Shopping Center. It's in the script.
That could be the real show.
You didn't put that in there?
No, I did not.
I hope that's
accurate.
That's
why they let you on the air with me, Steve. You actually contribute to the program.
Okay.
I appreciate that.
I hope I'm right.
I want to go see her.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 girl power things to do in Kansas City this weekend. Just go to kcur.org. What do we have here?
Well, first we have a digression because I'm on the show. Okay, that is actually the title track that we're listening to, the instrumental title track from the classic Beach Boys album Pet Sounds, right?
Yes.
And it makes the perfect intro to Kansas City Pet Expo. They'll be arfing and purring and tweeting from 10 to 5 Saturday and 11 to 4 Sunday at the Hale Arena down in the West Bottoms. We got a lot
that
of ground.
That means lots of cats, and I don't like them.
It's everything. It's reptiles.
Don't
it's
like
birds. How about reptiles and birds?
If they didn't have cats, I might go.
Well, I guess I will not see you there. They have dogs and cats, but I mean, there's going to be a slew of fun kind of tongue-in-cheek stuff like an adoptable parade of rescue pets. Well, that's serious enough. But there'll be a happiest pet and a biggest smile pet contest. Get this, they're going to have pet guardian musical chair competitions where, get this is really too much, the music stops, right? Like in musical chairs.
Yeah.
But then the handlers instruct their dogs to sit only by verbal request and hand signal, all right? So they cannot pick the dog up and put it in the chair. When was the last time you saw a dog get up in a chair?
That's all I care about. Dogs and Patti LaBelle, who's not going to be there in Brookside on Saturday. Just to correct the record
here.
The script was an error. She's only performing at the Kauffman Center.
Oh, well, okay. That's okay. That's all right.
We have here.
Well, for some reason, they call this noise pop. I think it sounds fairly straightforward to me, but I love that big, crunchy guitar and those dreamy vocals careening over the top. This is a New York duo. They are called Sleigh Bells. Alexis Krauss and Derek Miller, Friday, 9 o'clock at the Granada Theater in downtown Lawrence. Well worth the drive to Lawrence, Kansas. I was watching the official video to this song, which is called I'm a big fan, as you can tell. It's Just Us Now, and the way the mascara runs down the face of Alexis Krauss in Sleigh Bells, boy, I hope it runs down her face this weekend in Lawrence, because it looked pretty crazy, wild, nuts.
I just want to point to a quick one: an all-star jazz band at Johnson County Community College Sunday night, playing the music of Dizzy Gillespie and others, Chris Potter, other performers. One of the great jazz shows of the year.
Wow!
Johnson County Community College Sunday evening. Go to their website for more information.
You're getting it all in.
I know. And finally today,
the water is wide. I cannot cross all, and neither have I wings to fly.
That's Connie Dover. What a great voice.
I'm sure you've had her on the show.
I have had her on the show. It's been too long.
No, I don't want to say we saved the best for last, but let me just say,
we've
saved the best for last, because Connie Dover has a truly beautiful soprano singing voice.
She does.
She continues to enrapture folk music fans, not only here in Kansas City, where she's from, right? Well, actually, she was born in Arkansas, but she's been here for decades, but well beyond. She has a worldwide fan base, thanks to the World Wide Web. Catch her, Connie Dover, with Kelly Wirtz in the St. Patrick's Day weekend folk concert to savor at 6:30 Saturday night in the comfy acoustic alcove at Unity Village.
Great pick.
Oh, I melt. I melt when I listen to her sing.
That's Brian McTavish in your weekend to-do list. Thanks, buddy.
Thank you, my friend.
Nice job.
Yes.
You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to follow KCUR on Facebook. Tomorrow, a music icon, Robbie Robertson of the band. We'll talk to him and former Kansas governor and Obama cabinet member Kathleen Sebelius. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatacoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.